Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, December 5th, 2022. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Here are some headlines. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today on whether a Colorado anti-discrimination law violates a website designer's free speech because she only designs wedding web pages for heterosexual couples. The designer and her supporters say that a ruling against her would force her to do work that is against her faith. Her opponents say that if she wins, a range of businesses will be able to discriminate. We'll hear from both attorneys in the case coming up. Tomorrow is Election Day, again, in Georgia's U.S. Senate race between Democratic incumbent Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker. The two crisscrossed the state over the weekend to make final appeals to voters. And according to Politico, both parties are expecting a close outcome. We'll hear what the candidates are telling Georgians coming up. The White House says it opposes using the annual defense spending bill to repeal a vaccine mandate for military service members getting the COVID-19 vaccine. National Security spokesperson John Kirby told reporters that both President Biden and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin believe the mandate should remain in place. Republican lawmakers have threatened to delay passage of the defense spending bill if the vaccine mandate is not repealed. We'll have more on this coming up. And we'll also hear from Bloomberg Government's Zach Cohen about negotiations to keep the government funded and open past December 16th. Arizona's top officials have certified the state's 2022 election results. The move formalizes victories for Democrats over several Republicans who falsely claimed the 2020 election was rigged. As mandated by state law, Democratic Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, who is now governor-elect, Republican Governor Doug Ducey, Republican Attorney General Mark Brnovich, and State Supreme Court Chief Justice Robert Brutinel all met earlier today to canvass the election, and all three signed the certification documents. The move opens a five-day window for formal election challenges. Republican Carrie Lake, who lost the race for governor, is expected to file a lawsuit after weeks of criticizing the administration of the election. We begin here in D.C. at the Supreme Court, where justices heard oral arguments in the case of 303 Creative v. Alenis. It centers on whether a Colorado anti-discrimination law violates a website designer's free speech because she only designs websites for heterosexual couples. Here's a part of today's proceedings and an exchange between Justice Samuel Alito and Colorado Solicitor General Eric Olson.
I'll ask you, and then I'll finish this line, some hypotheticals in a brief submitted by Josh Blackman. A Jewish man and a Jewish woman who were engaged to be married ask a Jewish website designer to build a website to celebrate their upcoming, their nuptials. No problem, okay? Another Jewish man and a Christian woman who were engaged to be married ask a Jewish website designer to build a website to celebrate their nuptials. Big problem. Quote, many Jews consider intermarriage an existential threat to the future of Judaism. Does that website have to accept the second couple?
Again, as we talked about before, if the Jewish website designer has very explicitly Jewish themes on the wedding. They don't need to, on the website, they don't need to take that down for the inter-religious couple that comes. But if they offer a general service to the public, they need to offer that regardless of the customer's religion.
So the fact that they offer this to, that this is a Jewish, that is offered mostly to Jews, that's enough to make it, or exclusively to Jews, that's enough to make it sufficiently selective to get them out from your...
No, I'm drawing a distinction between what the website designer chooses to put on the website and who the website designer sells the website to. The website designer can choose to put on their websites whatever they want, but they just can't refuse to sell, if they're a public accommodation, they can't refuse to sell that website to someone solely because of their customers or the couple's religion.
Okay, an unmarried Jewish person asks a Jewish photographer to take a photograph for his J-Date dating profile. Is it a dating service, I gather, for Jewish people?
It is.
All right. Maybe Justice Kagan will also be familiar with the next website I'm going to mention. So next, a Jewish person asks a Jewish photographer to take a photograph for his AshleyMadison.com dating profile. I'm not suggesting that. I mean, she knows a lot of things. I'm not suggesting that. Okay. Does he have to do it?
Well, again, it would what Colorado looks, it depends. What Colorado looks to is what services the photographer makes available to the public. And if the photographer makes that service available to others taking pictures, you know, for use on websites, then probably yes. But it depends on.
Okay, Justice, then I really will stop. Justice Jackson's example of the Santa in the mall who doesn't want his picture taken with black children. So if there's a black Santa at the other end of the mall and he doesn't want to have his picture taken with a child who's dressed up in a Ku Klux Klan outfit, that black Santa has to do that?
No, because Ku Klux Klan outfits are not protected characteristics under public accommodation laws.
And presumably that would be the same Ku Klux Klan outfit, regardless whether the child was black or white or any other characteristic.
Yeah, you do see a lot of black children in Ku Klux Klan outfits, right? All the time.
That was Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, Colorado Solicitor General Eric Olson, and we heard Justice Elena Kagan in there as well. And Politico writes that the case, quote, could serve as a vehicle for the High Court's 6-justice conservative majority to effectively pare back LGBTQ rights without attacking head-on recent Supreme Court decisions guaranteeing the right to same-sex marriage and finding that existing laws against sex discrimination protect LGBTQ people from discrimination. Here's more from today's oral argument with the attorney for 303 Creative LLC, Kristen Wagner, and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
In the same way, I would say, first of all, in the same way that this court, when there is a message and a status and it's overlapping, the court would say that message wins in that instance. I don't think that that message is in that hypothetical, but take the example of the musical of Hamilton. There's a direct overlap in the musical of Hamilton. And in that case, we know that they're expressing a preference for who they're hiring in terms of race.
No, yet I'm not talking about that. You're sort of slipping into it like 1,000 different analogies. I just want you to focus on whether or not I have speech when I am a photography business and I hang out my shingle, everybody can come, but I have certain products that I'll only sell to white individuals because the speech that I'm trying to depict is the authentic depiction of that scene as I understand it and that I want to put out there in the world. And it has my signature on the bottom of it, so people are seeing my photos. And I want my photos of It's a Wonderful Life to be as authentic as possible, meaning no people of color.
It seems in each iteration of the hypothetical, the objection is changing. What I can articulate is the test, and I can also say that when there is an overlap between message and status, message does win, and Hamilton provides an example of that.
All right, thank you.
That's Kristen Wagner, the attorney for 303 Creative LLC, and Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. The court is expected to rule on this case next year. Tomorrow is decision day in Georgia's U.S. Senate race runoff between incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock and Republican Herschel Walker. Our early turnout has broken statewide daily voting records 3 times since early voting started, and election experts tell ABC News the unusually high early turnout is in part due to a condensed voting period that was part of the state's controversial elections overhaul last year. And here are the latest ads running for each candidate in Georgia.
I believe in voting. Democracy is the house we live in. Democracy is on the ballot, and the best thing you can do for democracy right now is to show up. If you stand with me, I'll stand up for you for 6 more years.
I've never been more optimistic about the future of our state. But look, we cannot rest on our laurels, everyone. You're going to decide who our senator is. This is going to be a turnout election. Who's more motivated? Is it them or us? That's right. And that's why it's time to retire Raphael Warnock and send Herschel Walker to the United States Senate.
I'm Herschel Walker, and I approve this message.
That is the ads we heard there with Herschel Walker, the Republican running for U.S. Senate from Georgia. And that was Brian Kemp, Georgia's governor. Before that, an ad for the incumbent Democrat, Raphael Warnock. You can stay tuned to C-SPAN for the latest results from the race. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more of today's headlines. The FBI is now investigating the power outages in North Carolina that left around 40,000 customers in the dark on Saturday night. The Moore County Sheriff's Office began a criminal investigation into the outage over the weekend when utility crews found signs of potential vandalism at different sites, including two substations that had been damaged by gunfire. About 36,000 customers were still in the dark as of Monday morning. A new study by NASA has found that sea levels are likely rising faster than previously thought. The study looked at three decades of satellite observations and concluded that sea levels along the continental U.S. coastline could rise more than a foot in some places by 2050. The NASA findings support the higher range scenarios that were outlined in a previous multi-agency report that was released in February. The NASA report suggested that waters could rise up to 10 to 14 inches along the eastern U.S. coastline, 14 to 18 inches along the Gulf Coast, and 4 to 8 inches along the Pacific coast. And according to the Oxford University Press, they're the publishers behind the Oxford English Dictionary, the 2022 Oxford Word of the Year is goblin mode. That is a type of behavior which is, quote, unapologetically self-indulgent, lazy, slovenly, or greedy, typically in a way that rejects social norms or expectations. Now, this was the first time the Oxford Word of the Year was chosen by the public. The other choices were metaverse and hashtag I stand with. Back here in Washington, Congress returned to work today, facing a deadline to fund the government through next year and avert a shutdown. Current money runs out on December 16th. Both the House and Senate are also taking up 2023 defense programs and policy legislation. House leaders are expected to bring a compromise version of a defense authorization bill to the floor this week, but details of what it will look like are still unknown. The House version that was passed over the summer cost $840 billion. It also includes a 4.5% pay raise for troops. With more on what's ahead this week in the Senate, here's Majority Leader Chuck Schumer during his leader time remarks.
We have 26 days left in the calendar year, and there's still a lot we have to do. This week, the House is expected to take up the annual defense authorization bill, priming the Senate to take action perhaps as soon as next week. The Senate's work on funding the government also continues. I just finished a meeting with the Republican leader about finding a constructive path forward to keep the government funded next fiscal year. Leader McConnell and I have both publicly affirmed the importance of getting this done, because our troops, our military, and our national security depends on it. And this Wednesday, in fact, the Senate will hold another classified briefing on the state of play in Ukraine, and I hope that my colleagues recognize how funding the government is inextricably tied to supporting Ukraine while protecting American national security here at home. The two are tied together. So we're going to continue negotiations until we get the job done on funding the government. Both sides recognize the importance, so now both sides must chart a path forward together. On judges, Mr. President, the Senate is just a few confirmation votes away from reaching another milestone. Soon we will confirm our 90th federal judge under President Biden. I want to thank my colleague, Chair of the Judiciary Committee, Senator Durbin, for his diligence and hard work in this area of getting nominees appointed to the bench. We vote today on Judge Number 88, Doris Pryor, tapped by the President to serve as U.S. Circuit Judge for the Seventh Circuit. She'll be the 26th Circuit Court Judge the Senate confirms in the last 2 years. These appointments are critical. Even though a conservative majority presides on the Supreme Court, the bulk of all federal cases are still resolved by Circuit Court judges. If confirmed, Judge Pryor will make history as the first woman of color from Indiana ever to sit on the Seventh Circuit. One judge at a time, the Senate continues fulfilling its mission of making sure our courts reflect the diversity and dynamism of America.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer during his leader time remarks on the floor earlier today, and as we heard him mention, the most pressing item on Congress's agenda is to keep the federal government open and funded past December 16th. According to The Hill, if negotiators need more time, it's likely that Congress will pass a short-term bill that funds the government up to December 23rd. And with more on what a government funding bill could include, here's Bloomberg Government's congressional reporter, Zach Cohen.
We are less than 2 weeks away from the deadline that Congress set for itself to fund the government through September 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year here in Washington. So that December 16th deadline is coming up, and there's actually not even a bill yet that's still being written between Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate that would fund everything from the military to health programs and everything in between. And this is all the discretionary spending, you know, Medicare, Social Security, that's all covered, but it's everything else that still needs to be worked out. And those negotiations are still ongoing. So we expect in the next couple of days to see a bill that either would be sort of a stopgap measure that could get them past a December 16th deadline and avoid a government shutdown. With Democrats in full control of Washington, it seems unlikely that a shutdown would happen. But there are a lot of really senior lawmakers that are looking for what's called an omnibus, basically a full government spending bill that would fund the government through September 30th.
Have we had any indication what the top line figure will look like as far as this bill is concerned?
That is the multi-trillion dollar question at this point, is they haven't agreed how much of that bill should go toward defense spending and how much should go toward non-defense spending, which is really the first critical thing that they have to work out. Obviously, Republicans would like to see more spending on defense than Democrats would. Democrats would like to see more spending on non-defense spending. And once they get past that, then they can figure out what goes to what department. And that really is the first key issue they have to work out.
Is the omnibus the main package being worked on? Is it potential that they could pass another package and just keep current spending levels at the same rate for a year, the course of a year or so?
That's right. So they have what's called a continuing resolution, which is what the government is on now. Basically, since September 30th, the government has just been spending at the current levels, sort of on autopilot, so to speak. And again, that expires December 16th, and they could opt to do that again. If they don't have some form of an agreement for a full omnibus package, they could opt to create another CR that lasts a week, a month, or even a full year. There's pros and cons for all of that for the two different parties. So obviously, if they kick it to a week, that could give them just enough time to come up with a deal. If they kick it to January, Republicans take over the House at that time, and certainly Republicans would like a greater say in that spending package, and that's one way to accomplish that. The other option is a full year CR, basically saying we're not going to pass a regular spending bill. We're just going to sort of let the government coast in terms of its spending decisions. And that has actually riled up some Republicans, because that would essentially mean a cut to defense spending. Because inflation is so high, it would mean a real cut to defense spending. And that's something that Republicans really would like to avoid.
Zach Cohen, we've talked a lot in the last couple of weeks about Speaker McCarthy and his efforts to become House Speaker. But as far as chairs of major committees, what should we look out for in the next Congress?
Most of the Republicans that will chair these major committees going into the next 2 years are going to be what are called the ranking members for the current committees now. So you've got people like Michael McCaul, who's probably going to be the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. There's some jockeying, however, for other powerful panels like the Ways and Means Committee between Congressman Vern Buchanan, Congressman Jason Smith, and Congressman Adrian Smith. And that should get worked out in the next couple of days. There's something called the Steering Committee, basically a set of House Republicans that include top leadership as well as some rank and file that basically hear arguments, these coming days from these Republicans that would like to chair these committees. And they'll make those decisions, and that'll be up to a vote of the full conference. And so while certainly a lot of the work gets done on the floor and in leadership offices, committees still are a place where a lot of the nitty-gritty details still get worked out. We're seeing this in the appropriations process. Congresswoman Kay Granger is likely to be the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. It'll actually be the first time in American history where all four top appropriators, House, Senate, Democrats, and Republicans, are all going to be women, which is kind of interesting. And so all those decisions will get worked out, and the people who are going to have the greatest say on really substantive policy issues, that's going to get worked out very soon.
House Judiciary, what does that look like?
Congressman Jim Jordan is the likely chairman of that committee. He's the ranking member now. I was talking to current chairman Jerry Nadler, the New York Democrat, and I was asking him, what do you think you can get done with Congressman Jordan? He didn't really have a great answer. He hasn't really had those conversations yet. And I think part of that is because Jordan has been very focused on oversight and looking into big tech and the Department of Justice and all of its actions over the last 2 years. And so I anticipate the House Judiciary Committee would kind of become the locus of the oversight proceedings in Congress, along with the House Oversight Committee led by Congressman James Comer.
I heard it said that, or at least reported that, 40 or 50 things they could be looking into. How Republicans come up with a strategy to keep the investigations going and yet not overshadow legislative efforts?
One of the cliches in Congress is, we know how to walk and chew gum at the same time. We'll see if that's the case. You know, Democrats had to deal with this when they were impeaching former President Donald Trump not once but twice. And there are ways, you know, that you can expend floor time on bills. Other committees can focus on other bills. But members of Congress, you know, can only juggle so much in their heads at one time. And so certainly we'll see if Republicans, many of whom are new to governing, most of them have not been in a House majority before. We'll see if they're able to sort of juggle both the oversight as well as the legislation that needs to happen.
Bloomberg Government's Zach Cohen on today's Washington Journal. You can see the whole segment at cspan.org/Washington Journal and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. And according to a story in the Washington Post, a bipartisan group of senators are working on an immigration reform package that they want to pass before Republicans take control of the House in January. Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema and North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis have outlined a proposal that would provide a path to legalization for 2 million undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States as children. They're known as Dreamers. It also includes at least $25 billion in increased funding for the Border Patrol and border security. Immigration was the topic of Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell's leader time remarks on the Senate floor earlier today.
2 years into the Biden administration, the Democrats' approach to illegal immigration and our nation's borders has failed the American people. Last week, one news organization reported that daily crossings along our southern border have remained near record highs. Last fiscal year alone, more than 2.76 million illegal immigrants came across our southern border, absolutely smashing the previous record high by more than a million. That's almost the equivalent of a full 1% of our total national population encountered on our southern border in just 1 year. And the problem actually keeps getting worse. Reported estimates say that more than 73,000 new gotaways dodged Border Patrol and escaped into our country in just this past November alone. Absurdly, the response to this crisis from President Biden's team is that everything is fine, going according to plan. Secretary Mayorkas said last month, quote, "What we're doing is precisely what we announced we would do in April of this year, and we have indeed been executing on the plan." Now, everybody else in the country calls our functionally open borders an emergency and a crisis, but apparently the Biden administration calls it mission accomplished. And bear in mind, the terrible and unacceptable status quo has come with some emergency COVID measures still in place. All this crisis-level numbers I just ran through have come with these extra border controls called Title 42 actually still in effect. Now, one federal judge is trying to force the Biden administration to do what the far left has wanted for months and actually repeal the policy. So the unacceptable crisis-level status quo may only be the warm-up act compared to coming attractions.
Leader time remarks from Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell earlier today on the Senate floor. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was also asked about immigration and border security today. He spoke at an event sponsored by the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Leader McCarthy, who's the presumptive incoming House Speaker, says that he's going to hold investigations, and he's even gone as far as calling for your impeachment. What will you tell Congress if you are called in front of a committee?
In response to what question?
In response to whether why they believe they are accusing this administration of failing to address the border crisis.
Well, we are devoting tremendous resources to address the border in a way that achieves its security and upholds our values as a country. We are modernizing our systems at the border to expedite processing and bring greater efficiency to it. We are intensely focused on this mission set, just as we are intensely focused on the mission sets that we confront as a department from top to bottom.
And also on the agenda at the event, the issue of homegrown terrorism.
I speak to a lot of officials who were around in the earliest days of the formation of DHS, and they acknowledge that domestic terrorism wasn't really something that they thought about a lot in those days. Obviously, we were very focused on what was happening overseas. But right now, insider threats, domestic terrorism, domestic extremism are very real, and we saw it here in Washington, of course, that it can get very dangerous. But it goes beyond that. Growing concerns about infiltration of the military, infiltration of law enforcement, infiltration of CBP. These are real concerns that are growing by the day, and I wonder how the department is stepping up efforts to combat that, not just in the country, but also in-house.
So let me take a step back and talk about it in the country first. So we built a capability that was directly relevant and critical to addressing the domestic threat environment that did not occur 10 years ago. And that is the capability to predicate our work on a public-private partnership. That's what our department does. And we took that model and applied it to the domestic threat landscape, and we're now working with communities across the country to ensure that they build the capacity and they have the equipment and the resources to address the threat that they encounter on their streets and their neighborhoods. So the public-private partnership that we've been working on as part of the core muscle of the department is directly applicable to a really more dynamic threat domestically than we've experienced before. The issue of addressing individuals who follow extremist views within our ranks that imperil the integrity of our work or that could potentially have a nexus to violence is something that we have actually undertaken a significant review. The Department of Defense did as well. We conducted a review. We develop recommendations from that review, and that work has to be an ongoing one.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas speaking at an event today at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was responding to a question from Wall Street Journal national security reporter Vivian Salama. You can see the entire event at cspan.org.
And we do have confirmation of an acquisition of signal on the Deep Space Network in Goldstone at 11:12 a.m. Central. You're getting a view of the lunar surface from Orion's perspective.
That is NASA Mission Control following the final pass of the Orion spacecraft over the surface of the moon earlier today. The flyby gave mission leaders views of several lunar sites, including a couple of the Apollo landing sites. After that, Orion fired up its main engine for about 3.5 minutes. That's the longest burn of the trip so far, and set off on its 239,000-mile trip back home to Earth. It's scheduled to splash down in the Pacific Ocean off San Diego on December 11th, capping off a 1.3-million-mile trip. And a reminder, you can find this program as a podcast at cspan.org/podcast. It's also on our C-SPAN Now mobile app or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, you can subscribe to our evening newsletter, Word for Word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.